Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to our second hearing of the Health, Finance, and Policy Committee. I expect that we will have a somewhat easier day today, a little bit less challenging for folks, and we can kind of take a step back and learn a little bit about the subject matter before the committee. There is a quorum, and I will entertain a motion to approve the minutes of January 5th.
Motion to approve, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Vice Chair Bierman. Moves approval of the minutes of January 5th, 2023. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. So the first thing on our agenda today is a we have some overviews, and we have the commissioner of the health department here again with us. Welcome, Commissioner. And we also have Deputy Commissioner Kelly with us. So I don't know, Deputy Commissioner Kelly, if you're going to be speaking or you're just here for questions. No. Okay. All right. So Commissioner, welcome to the committee, and the floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Chair Liebling. Happy to be back in front of you all today to give an MDH overview of our agency. We're going to do a high-level overview. You all should have the materials with the deck. I'll cover about half of the slides, and then there's some slides towards the back for your reference that I won't get into today, but please feel free to answer questions at any point, and I can stop and answer those questions. So I just want to start by discussing our mission at MDH. Our mission is to protect, maintain, and improve the health of all Minnesotans. And let's talk about how we deliver on this mission here this morning. I will say that the good news is that Minnesota has been ranked consistently as one of the healthiest states in the nation. Unfortunately, with what we've seen with health inequities in the state and even our funding of public health, over time our rankings have dropped a bit with that. And we're going to talk about some of those reasons here today. So first, to start with a broad overview about what determines our health. This pie chart describes the factors that are affected with our health. And the small role particularly played by clinical health care, only 10%, that small blue slither in the chart. And the much larger role of the physical environment, of health behaviors, and of our social and economic status. And yet, when we discuss the big health issues of the day, we focus far more attention, resources, and healthcare spending on that small blue slither than that larger, darker blue 40% with social and economic factors. I want to put this in context of the sort of global environment around health and human services investment. This is an older slide from 2011, but I think it's illustrative. We can see the red is the U.S., where we talk about the percent of our expenditures in health and human services as part of overall GDP. And other countries invest greater resources in prevention and social services, which is the green bar, that have a greater impact on health and healthcare than the blue bar, which is medical care expenditures. So this chart from 2011 shows that investments in the U.S. are overall in public health and social services are overall much lower than other countries and have been more focused on medical care than public health. So in other countries, for every $1 spent on health care, about $2 is spent on prevention and other social services. In the U.S., for about every $1 spent on health care, about 55 cents are spent on prevention and social services. And so when we look at more up-to-date data from the Kaiser Family Foundation, and if you pay attention to that green bar at the bottom, we see 10 years later the story is quite similar. And so healthcare spending is in the graph on the right, and you can see that we outpace other comparable nations. Yet, given that our spending is almost double those nations, our life expectancy is much lower, as you can see from the left bar graph. And looking at the same data, we see that life expectancy in recent years in the United States, which is in that green bar line at the bottom, has actually declined significantly despite increasing investments in health care. This certainly could be driven by COVID in part, but other countries are seeing a rebound in life expectancy compared to the United States. And to further contextualize this, when we look at total U.S. distribution of health resources, we can see that public health investment, again, this is the green little piece at the end of those bars, lags behind the investment at the national level. So at a national level, public health spending is about 5% of the overall distribution of U.S. health resources. In Minnesota, it's about 3%. Of the distribution of our health care spending. And I want to just describe for you all, our colleagues here from DHS, you'll be hearing from them shortly, but I want to sort of make clear some of the differences that we see between public health and health care. So public health really tends to work more upstream than the health care sector, focusing on prevention, working at the community level to promote wellness, and tracking population health. So we really concentrate on upstream factors such as drinking water, food standards, infectious disease, maternal child health, cancer screening, nutrition, and facility regulations for facilities like long-term care. And so you will see the graphic on the right with the yellow lifting up population health, which is why you see a number of people in the center of that circle. Whereas healthcare tends to, not exclusively, but tends to focus on individual level care. And so you see that one person in the middle of that circle, healthcare focusing on medical treatments, individual quality of life, some conditions in the home, and more recently, more attention to upstream factors. But these are some core historical differences between the sectors. So what we would see here on the left, we talk about healthcare, for example, in human service providing coverage for a child with measles. But we might talk about public health as providing information to parents about the value of measles immunizations, right? We might talk about healthcare enrolling people in health insurance to ensure chronic disease treatment, and we in public health in Minnesota would work with local governments, local public health, and other partners to reduce the prevalence of chronic disease. Healthcare human services might provide coverage for and treatment for people with addiction or overdose in a hospital or program, where we are much more focused on addressing the root causes of diseases of despair, and alcohol abuse, suicide, trauma, and other experiences such as adverse childhood events. So, simply put, DHS focuses on health care, providing coverage, individual-based care, individual supports, and MDH focuses on public health, education, prevention, and population-based care. And why are we lifting up that pie chart and these differences? Well, we're doing it in part as we think about how we spend funds and public dollars. It's to say that we can't afford to treat our way out of health. We do have to think about prevention. And what this graphic is showing that you all have is really the projected percent change in healthcare spending out to 2028. And you just see the graph, the slope is just going up and up and up. And so the spending is projected to increase for dementia by 67%, by hypertension for 59%, for diabetes by 51%, smoking exposure by 28%, obesity by 22%, right? And so more than 40% of Minnesota adults have at least one chronic condition, and about half of those have more than one chronic condition. And so the spending is just projected to rise. So how do we interrupt this? And that's sort of the work that we do within the Minnesota Department of Health. And when we think about the prevalence of chronic conditions, it's not solely due to health behaviors or the environment, but also due to societal factors. Chronic conditions are tied closely to where we live and work, to our culture, to our activities. Do you have access to health care? Do you have access to meaningful work? Are you living free from stress, from discrimination, and racism? And again, in Minnesota, despite being among some of the healthiest states on average, we have some of the nation's worst health disparities. Compared to whites, Minnesota's populations of color and American Indians experience shorter lifespans, higher rates of infant mortality, higher incidence of diabetes, heart disease, and cancer, and poorer general health. These disparities negatively affect quality of life, cost of health care, and the overall health of all Minnesotans. And so let me also lift up a few insightful statistics. Black women are 2.5 times more likely than white women to die of their breast cancer within 5 years of diagnosis. In 2021, American Indian residents were 10 times more likely, and black Minnesotans were 4 times more likely than white residents to be treated in the hospital for a non-fatal drug overdose. Data show higher rates of heart disease in young and middle-aged black adults compared to the Minnesota average, approximately twice as high for black adults between the ages of 35 to 64, and about 50% higher for those 65 to 74. Almost two-thirds of new HIV cases are among communities of color. Among those under 65, when they died, the asthma rate for African Americans was 3 times higher than those of whites. And we have seen similar disparities during our COVID-19 pandemic. And part of what MDH was to stand up the response to really meet the needs of disproportionately impacted communities and those who are most impacted by COVID. And what did we do? We stood up testing sites, vaccination clinics, and referrals to therapeutics. We partnered with community-based organizations to reach the hardest-hit communities. We provided staffing resources to long-term care and to hospitals. We provided expanded access to COVID-19 treatments, and we stood up a hotline for the general public to use when they had questions or concerns. And the challenge for us in public health and in healthcare in general is prevention is often invisible. Our greatest successes are often invisible because they actually prevent those downstream problems. And briefly, I would like to share with you all, as you all think about the Minnesota Department of Health, the national model about the foundations of public health. In Minnesota, our public health system is based on state-local partnership that focuses on five primary foundations of public health: controlling communicable diseases like COVID-19, preventing chronic disease and injury, protecting our health through environmental activities like safe drinking water, promoting health at an early age through maternal, child, and family health activities, particularly at MDH, and promoting access to clinical care, particularly filling those gaps. The foundational capabilities identified in the blue boxes below the diagram need to be embedded at a county or regional level to ensure strong public health going forward into the future. And those boxes include assessment and disease surveillance, community partnership and development, health equity, organizational competencies, policy development support and analysis, accountability and performance management, emergency preparedness and response, and communications. In 2021, the legislature allocated resources to support the first steps of public health system transformation, a long-term strategy to build capacity and capability at the local level. Our local partners are incredibly important to our work. The bill language directed MDH to assess the current state of the governmental public health system, give grants to community health boards to test new models for public health service delivery, develop recommendations for long-term system change, and report back to the legislature in 2023, which we just did a few weeks ago. Please do look at that report. It reflects shared analysis, action, and recommendations, and the recommendations of MDH, the State Community Health Services Advisory Committee, and the local public health association. And so with that overview about the work that we do at MDH, I want to talk more about our workforce and our funding.
And Commissioner, this might be just a good moment to take a pause for just 1 second. And I just want to, I didn't say at the beginning of the hearing that it would be good if members hold questions till the commissioner is done speaking, and then we'll ask questions of the commissioner. But if you have a clarifying question in the meantime, please do let us know if you don't know what an acronym means or something like that. That's just a brief piece of information you need, and then we could pause for that. But I also do want to just say, with what the commissioner's gone through here, I hope that all members realize what an excellent Department of Health we have in this state. The department was so severely tested during the pandemic, which is not over, but, you know, the worst parts of the pandemic. I mean, members need to really understand, and I think when you hear from the Department of Human Services, you'll maybe get the context of how small the Department of Health really is compared to the Department of Human Services. But their employees shifted around to all kinds of different areas where they were needed. They worked their tails off fighting the pandemic, trying to keep Minnesotans safe and healthy. And I just think it's important for us to take a pause here and really recognize how fortunate we are to have the incredible staff that this agency has and the incredible leadership that it's had, including, of course, Commissioner Malcolm, who is now retired. And anyway, I just really wanted to say that because I think as those of you who are new go to other states, perhaps, or to conferences and hear from what's going on in other states, you may really begin to get a flavor of how well Minnesota does on a lot of these things, notwithstanding the fact that we have a lot further to go on a lot of issues. But I just want to say thank you to all of the staff of the department.
Thank you so much.
Go ahead, Commissioner, and give us a talk about the money now.
Thank you. No, that's incredibly important. Thank you for saying that. Our staff have worked really hard throughout the COVID pandemic. They've been really dedicated. They're really terrific to work with, and I have been at the agency for 10 months before this role, and part of the reason that I am staying is the people and their commitment and their hard work and their talent and their expertise. So please call on us as a resource, but I'll get to the money, because I think part of the story for the budget session going forward is and Commissioner Malcolm would often say public health goes from feast or famine or panic and neglect. There we go. And so we want to interrupt that cycle from panic to neglect. And so when we talk about the budget, MDH spending has been significantly impacted by both state and federally funding during the COVID response, almost doubling our biennial expenditures. But prior to the pandemic, MDH spending across all funds was just over about $1 billion each biennium. And we expect our funding to return to similar levels in the next 2 to 4 years. And so what you see here is the blue bars are all funding except the COVID-19 funding, which is demonstrated in the green bars for fiscal years 2021 and fiscal years 22 to 23. But the blue bars are sort of where our base budget has been and is projected to be. Our agency is funded from a number of funding sources, federal grants, the state's general fund, the healthcare access fund, and other state funds. Federal and general fund proportions stay relatively stable, biennium to biennium, and federal grants typically represent the largest share of our budget. So that's the brown bar at the top, which is our federal source of funding compared to the other funds. The general fund is right underneath that. We are estimating about 1,672 full-time equivalents are funded in our base budget for the next biennium. 45% of our employees are funded on federal grants, and only 13% are supported by the general fund. And of course, we have all types of staff, from scientific and program experts to epidemiologists, nurses, economists, data analysis, community health specialists, engineers, and folks in the laboratory. MDH has been fairly successful competing for federal grants. While the federal government funds some of our core public health activities, this level of support also adds complexity to our budget. It means we are implementing federally driven priorities, which may differ from state priorities. So the top two rows show that most of our federal funding is from two agencies: the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which supports our work around infectious diseases and chronic disease, and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which supports WIC, or Women, Infants, and Children's Nutrition Program. When we look at what we do with this money, 45% of our resources go out the door in grants and other forms of aid to support local and community partners. 29% of our resources cover operating expenses, primarily building leases and technology costs, and 26% of our resources cover employee compensation. When we look at spending by budget activity, you can see how our agency resources are invested programmatically in the slide. Child and family health spending, that dark green bar at the top, is driven by WIC, the nutrition program, which is a significant federal expenditure. And then the remaining bars in this slide go into greater detail about how much we spend. And the remaining slide, will go into greater detail about each budget activity and the outcomes we achieve with the resources we have. We've included them for your reference, but are not intending to walk through them today. Here are my contact information, Lisa Timden's, our legislative director's contact information, but we are happy to take any questions to answer your questions about our agency.
Well, thank you so much, Commissioner. We do have a question from Representative Quam, and then others, if you, and in it, just for those who are newer, just raise your hand, get our attention, we'll put you on the list, and we'll call folks in order. Representative Quam.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and if the information isn't available, if you can get it to the committee after. On your chart that showed the United States expenditures as a percent of GDP, do you have a breakdown of government spending versus employer spending versus individual spending? That would be nice to understand that. Then on your chart for life expectancy per capita, with the United States at 76.1, what amount of that hit is due to the huge increase in fentanyl poisoning and deaths, which is, I believe, now the highest cause of death for, 18 to 35 or 45-year-olds?
Mm-hmm.
It'd be nice to understand the major contributors to that discrepancy from the other countries. Then you have on your public versus health care, on public health, what initiatives is the department going to do for individualized health care, such as pharmacogenomics or other things which have shown that the common medications prescribed for many conditions and diseases are not as effective with some portions of the population? So improving the delivery and focusing and borrowing from the individualized health care that the U of M, Mayo, and other entities of the state are working on, and how that might be able to address some of the discrepancies. Then on your chart that shows a increase in multiple things, I noticed there's an accelerating increase on that chart for, you know, dementia, hypertension, et cetera. It'd be nice if the committee had what the current levels are, so we understand where we're at today, because projections don't always, show that accuracy. And then,
Representative Quam,
Madam Chair,
I'm afraid this might be a little overwhelming. I just want to make sure that we are I assume that you're all tracking and taking notes. And okay, do you have very much more?
I'm most of the way through. Thank
okay, because it might. It sounds like some of this might need to be taken offline. You know, that you can talk, but go ahead.
Madam Chair, that's why I said she could provide
Absolutely.
It later. When you're doing a correlation of disparities. It'd be nice to see what the component of single-parent households is affecting, because that might help us with delivery and connecting, and maybe having continuity between schools and other support programs. And then finally, over the years, you know, more than a decade, there have been several occasions where there have been audits, and there's found some fraud issues, and I know the public hears about these and they wonder what we're doing. What's the department doing to improve the situation with some of the level of fraud, especially with, I guess, the paperwork and articles about the COVID dollars besides other programs? So, again, that offline, if you can give the committee that information, would be useful. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Quam. So, Commissioner, I don't know if you want to address any of that right now, or if, you know, this is all that was a lot. I don't think I would be prepared to go back through everything Representative Quam asked about, but please go ahead if you want to respond to any of it right now.
Thank you for those questions. We will have to circle back to you. I will just say at a very high level, we very much care about what the upstream drivers are for all of these conditions. Clearly, with life expectancy, we've seen a lot more deaths associated with opioid use, and we know the role that fentanyl is playing in that, so clearly that's very important. For some of the discrete data elements that you are requesting, I'll have to definitely go back to the team. Clearly, with pharmacogenomics as a medical treatment, it's not a space that sort of MDH sort of sits in, but we are aware of those activities in the medical treatment space. But again, part of our focus is really on those upstream societal factors that cause downstream illness that then needs those treatments that you're talking about with pharmacogenomics. Clearly, we want to support families of all types. That's part of what we have to think about in terms of thinking about, as I had mentioned here, when we talked about children, having them grow up in safe and sustainable communities. That means supporting parents and families of all types. And so we're minding, particularly in our Child and Family Health Division, about what are the ways that we do that with WIC, with family home visiting, and other sorts of supports. I mean, looking at the experiences of kids, I had mentioned adverse childhood events, and sort of those sorts of experiences, we are very mindful and have work and particularly studies going on in. Our legislative director, I know, tracked many of your questions, Representative, and we will circle back with you on the answers for the other things. But thank you for your interest in all of those areas.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. We have Representative New Brindley, Nadeau, hope I'm saying that right. Am I saying it right? And then Smith. And then I think we will, unless there's anything else pressing, I think then we can let this team go, and then we're going to hear from the Department of Human Services. So, Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for being here. I apologize, the slides are not marked, but I'll try to scroll through them. But on that, the expenditures as a percentage of GDP and the comparison with other countries, I'm wondering if you can just give us an idea of what are some of the things that these other countries are doing with that funding, and what kind of success do you see through some of those programs?
Yes, thank you.
Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. That is a question, Representative Birling, that I will have to get back to you on in terms of what sorts of initiatives, innovative programs, things that they might be doing similar or different to us. I am very interested in making sure that we're a learning organization, right? Learning from both other countries, but also local public health at MDH, community partners. We need to know what are the best practices, right, to advance health. And so it would be good to know, and we can circle back and with you about what they may be doing.
Madam Chair,
Representative,
thank you, and I appreciate that. That's the spirit in which I asked it. We should be learning, right? I mean, if they're doing other innovative things that is showing success, we should try to implement some of those things. On the slide on public health in Minnesota, I suppose there's several marked public health in Minnesota, but it was specifically the graph showing dementia, chronic conditions, hypertension, these different things that are driving some of this change. I'm just wondering how much of that, those sort of top four items, how much of that is just driven by having an aging population in the state? I mean, as you sort of look at those top four conditions that are significantly higher than the others, and I'm wondering how much of that is driven by an aging population versus just the overall health of our population?
Right. Mm-hmm. No.
Commissioner.
Thank you. I think that's a good question, and we often do look at sort of age-adjusted statistics to take account of sort of underlying population demographics, and so I can circle back to our health policy team to sort of get at how much is age versus other factors. I think the one thing that this graph is intended to demonstrate and to keep our eyes on is just the slope upward, right? And I think the slope upward, I would hypothesize that it's beyond just aging, right? It's that some of our conditions of living are not optimal for many Minnesotans. And so we can interrupt some of that upward trajectory that may be associated with age by really addressing those living conditions, those social and economic factors, and particularly addressing them early on, right? Because you get chronic disease later in life because of the situations that you were in earlier in life, right? And sort of all of these sort of accumulate on top of each other. And so that's in part where our focus must be in terms of interrupting the upstream factors.
Yeah. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, I wonder if also on sort of the budget items and the spending, I'm wondering if you could talk to us a little bit on you broke down the use of all funds in grants, aid, subsidies versus employee compensation versus operating expenditures. And I'm wondering if you can talk to us a little bit. The operating expenditure seems quite high. And so I'm wondering if you can just talk to us a little bit about maybe there are some things included in that we wouldn't commonly think of as included in operating expenditures, and why as a percentage that is high.
So I may turn that over to our Deputy Commissioner, Margie Kelly.
Okay, Deputy Commissioner Kelly, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. My name is Margaret Kelly, Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Health. Operating expenditures include things that are not grants going out to the public and not employee compensation. So things like our lease costs, mm-hmm. all of our technology-related costs that we get support from Minute, but we also support some internally. It includes contracts for consultants that we may have as well. Currently, we have many employees who are working for MDH under contract that we brought on to do COVID response. And so some of our employee compensation costs are also reflected in there. The big piece of this pie is to show you the percentage of our budget that goes out the door and is shared and used to leverage the work of community organizations and our partners at the local level. So while we do have almost $500 million annual budget, almost 50% of that goes out the door to our local partners. and the rest is to run the department.
Okay. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you. I think certainly the consultants, I would assume that leads to why that is such a high number. I hope that is the case, but that would be, I think we'd all be interested in learning a little bit more about that in the future. My last question, Madam Chair, I'm wondering if committee staff would be willing to send out that report to committee members so that we can all take a look at that.
The public health report they referred to?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Wonderful. And I did read it, and it's kind of an interim report, right? I think that what I mainly got from it was that there's a lot more to do. They're working diligently. It's pulling together a lot of different players, the counties, and, you know, really trying to reorganize. But these kind of things take time, and it was kind of that was the gist of it, I think, that there's more work to do, and they're continuing their work. But we'd be happy to send it out.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Commissioner. I'm going to build a little bit off of what Representative New Brindley said. Is how do you prioritize? I mean, you spend a lot of time talking about leveraging, you know, going upstream and trying to change those behaviors, which we all know takes a really long time. A lot of investment, a lot of time, a lot of commitment. How do you work with local partners in doing that? Who trumps? I mean, if the health department has an objective that they're trying to achieve with their money, local units of government have more specific community-based things that they're trying to achieve. How do you balance that between, you know, drinking water and alcoholism, for example? I mean, how do you do that at the state level and then measure that long term to determine whether or not those investments are actually creating that change that we're trying to find?
Commissioner.
Thank you so much. There are a lot of competing priorities in the space, is what I in part hear you asking. And I think we try to listen closely to community and to our partners. Community engagement is something that is critically important both to our governor as well as to me personally in terms of setting priorities and also thinking about innovative action plans. And so we have many things, and you all will see as we come forth, community-based organizations as partners, local public health as partners. Again, we do have to meet some of the deliverables of our federal grants that are our major fundings, and so a lot is sort of directed from what are the requests from those grants. And I might ask if I could, Mary, would you like to speak at all to this? This is our Assistant Commissioner of Health Promotion. And Mary, I'm bringing you down here just because of your longstanding experience in our department and in multiple roles. I would say for me, clearly, when we talk about moving upstream, it has to be in alignment and in partnership, not only with people outside of the state enterprise, but with you all in this room and people with other agencies within the state enterprise. And so so I'm saying that just to say that we can't do it alone to address these upstream factors that are shaping folks' lives. We have things that are right in the midst of our circle of control, right, in terms of delivery of some of these federal grant programs like WIC, but many things are outside our primary lane, so we must partner with others. So, Mary, would you add any comments?
Yeah, and welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Carolee Bing, Mary Manning, Assistant Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Health Representative. In the case of something like drinking water and alcoholism, we have commitments and requirements to address the drinking water. And so we have firm partnerships with our local partners and municipalities to work on drinking water. The issue of alcohol prevention and a lot of different things. We have a number of federal grants where, you know, we might be working on diabetes or cardiovascular disease or a number of things. And within the risk factors of addressing those issues, we work with our partners to address a number of risk factors, alcohol being one of them. And if the partners choose to address that, or, you know, those are, there are a number of risk factors, and that would be one that they might choose. We can't, we don't have the resources to deal with everything, so it's kind of like what our partners choose to do. We don't get a ton of resources where we have the ability to get to choose, like, that we're going to be able to work on this particular issue. But what we try to do is leverage when we know there's a problem and try to work with our partners to address it. So there's a lot of risk factors like that where we try to leverage the interest of our partners.
Right. Thank you. And, you know, the legislature has a role in helping to prioritize as well. And we will also be dealing more with the department's priorities when we look at their budget request.
Okay, great.
So there'll be a lot of opportunity to dig into that.
Okay. One final
question.
Okay,
yes. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you. And thank you for that. And I wasn't actually asking for a comparison between the two. It was just, how do we prioritize? And my gist is that you follow the lead of the local public health authority in many cases. Yes. They're the ones that know what those issues are.
Yes.
And you try to meld them in with the overarching goals of the Department of Health, theoretically.
That is correct.
Like, Commissioner.
We often, when we talk about grants going out, there are certain stipulations, but there's a lot of flexibility in those grants because, to your point, local Minnesotans know what's best for their communities. And so part of our job is to give them the information, for example, the data that can help inform their action plans, but also to sort of give them the flexibility whenever possible to implement in the ways that they know best.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, thank you. We do have a couple other members, and we need to finish up this.
Yep.
If you have something
super,
else short.
Super quick. This
okay.
is completely unrelated, but
no,
it's different. There was one slide, and I can't find it, but it was talking about the disparities between communities of color, and we hear that in Minnesota all the time. And is there, I mean, do other states, do other competing regions struggle with that like we do?
I think across the country, people are struggling with health inequities, in part because the legacy of health inequities is deep sort of within our country's history. And so multiple localities, municipalities see similar things. It is, though, when you look at the data, Minnesota consistently is ranking among the states with some of the worst disparities. Because when you think about the upstream determinants of health, access to high quality food, access to quality housing, access to high quality education, right? All of those things impact the downstream health outcomes and health inequities. And so we do have some real challenges in those spaces for Minnesotans of color.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. We're going to go to Representative Smith and then her. Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for that report. And also I want to echo what the Chair said earlier. We all thank you so much for your work the past 3 years. It's you and your staff. It's always essential, but I don't think it's ever been as public as it has been the past 3 years. So thank you very much. My question is on the expenditure history and outlay projection slide. Specifically, it looks like in the past two financial bienniums, it's been a little over $2 billion, and with TAILS included, about $2.2 billion extra needed. Obviously, that's expected with a global pandemic and where we were. My question is, in the interest of learning and preparing for, you know, we hope not, but further events like that in the future, is that a sort of expenditure to be expected? Are there ways that we can prepare for that better so that there's not that as huge a spike? Are there ways that we can better prepare, I guess, for a future public health crisis like that in the financial realm?
Right.
So, Commissioner, that sounds like an enormous question to me, but if you want to give a short answer, because I think we're going to probably hear more about that as the session goes on.
I think my shortest answer is sort of, again, going back to Commissioner Malcolm's quote about panic and neglect, and we really have to invest in our emergency response. So what you will see hopefully going forward is we'll have conversations about, well, what do we need for the public health system, which is the system of the state, so our Department of Health, our local public health partners, tribal health, right? What do we need to build out the infrastructure for all of health, but then particularly for emergency response. What do we need to maintain so that we don't lose momentum, so that we don't lose traction, so that if COVID, you know, rears its head again or another sort of emerging infectious disease comes along, we're better prepared.
Thank you, Smith. Okay. Representative Herr.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, just actually maybe one quick clarifying thing for Representative Nadeau, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but the reason why our disparities are so great is because our white population does much better than other states, and then our BIPOC community does worse than other states, which makes our disparity one of the biggest, whether it's health or income or wealth or education. That's sort of the same across the board. So it's not just in health, but it is, you know, other areas as well. So if I've said that wrong, you can correct me. But my question is just to the data that you spoke to about the disparities, because I know I started working in maternal health disparities about 5 years ago before I got to the legislature. And when I asked the question about what is the data on Asian Americans, and I was told that we don't collect data on Asian Americans, so we didn't know the disparities for Asian American women. And and maybe if that's wrong, you can let me know, but I worked with a task force that sort of looked at that. And so maybe if we could just you know, share a little bit about how you collect data and if you disaggregate the data. I think you're probably very well aware of this, that Minnesota is unique, and we all think our state is super unique, but Minnesota is unique in their AAPI community that on the coast, it's usually East Asians, and here in Minnesota, we have the largest Southeast Asian population. So Hmong women have the highest rates of cervical cancer. You know, we have certain diseases, like kidney disease, we have a really high rate. And so when we're not disaggregating that data and collecting it, we don't actually know how all of our communities are doing, and the Southeast Asian population generally trends very closely to the African American population. And so I just wanted to maybe understand a little bit more. Maybe this is a conversation you and I can take offline, but to just really understand how we collect that data and use it to inform the work that we're doing.
Thank you, Commissioner.
No, thank you so much. That is very close to my heart. Clearly, I come to this space from a research background. Have looked at the challenges with race data collection and the need to disaggregate, and not just disaggregate from sort of Minnesotans to what we typically do, which would be the five OMB categories, Office of Management and Budget categories from the feds that you know, that the census numbers round up to, and not just to sort of those five sort of racial groups, but even within group to what you're talking about in terms of our API community, in terms of African Americans, we must disaggregate that data. So I would love to continue to have a conversation around that. That is so important, just because we know that all of these big groups are very heterogeneous within the group. And so for us to have the greatest impact and to understand the greatest need, trying to get underneath these big categories, Asian, Black, American Indian, to get underneath that to really be more effective. So that is close to my concern as well for us as a state. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Commissioner and team. Thank you very much for your presentation today and for answering questions. We look forward to seeing you a lot in this committee, and we know you're going to be working very hard on a lot of other things, too, throughout the session. So
thank you.
Appreciate
thank
your
you
being
so
here today.
Thank you for your questions. I appreciate it. Reach out to us at any time. Thank you.
And now we're going to move on to our Department of Human Services, and the commissioner is here with us today. And thank you so much, and sitting through the other presentation, too. Really appreciate you being here. So welcome to the committee. The floor is yours. Please introduce yourself. Some people here may not know you yet.
Thank you very much. I'm Jody Harpstead, the Commissioner of the Department of Human Services, and we have our CFO, Dave Freeman, with us here today, and our Budget Director, Elise Bailey, who will be helping me with the presentation. Our format's a little different than health. I'm going to just do a few brief introductory slides, and then we'll show you what our finances look like from our budget office.
Okay. Commissioner, I'm having a little bit of trouble hearing you. Are you? Do you have the mic? I know the mics are really a little soft at the table, but I think that's better. Yeah. Thank you.
Is that better? Is that better? Getting better all the time.
Yes. Better and better.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the help.
Thank you.
So our human services system in Minnesota, you may know, we are one of 11 states that are state-funded and county and tribal administered for human services. And so we start with things that happen at the federal government and the state legislature, comes to the Department of Human Services. We work with our tribal nations and our counties as they administer human services, and they fund the various providers and nonprofits in the community, which is all to say it's complicated and more complicated than some states. Some other states will do a very general statute and have the department do rulemaking to shape the work. But in Minnesota, we had a consulting firm in a few years ago that rated Minnesota high for involvement of the legislature, where everything's in statute, and so it's complicated to implement these services in Minnesota. And needless to say, mistakes can happen, so we'll talk about that later. The mission of the department, working with many others, we help people meet their basic needs so they can live in dignity and achieve their highest potential. Just a brief word on the staff that I have. We've had changes at the Department of Human Services. Many of you knew Chuck Johnson, our deputy commissioner, who was in state government for 38 plus years. And as he retired last summer, we arranged some things in the department. So just to bring you back to up to date, our deputy commissioner for agency effectiveness, Shireen Gandhi, has been with us for several years and has taken on more and more responsibility while she's been with us. She now leads finance, compliance, what we call service transformation, which we'll talk about in a moment, and process improvement and equity. I think the most important thing is we have all of our control functions under one person now. You know that we've been working over the last 3 years to cross the T's and dot the I's, and Shireen has all of those functions under her in DHS, and that consolidation has been really beneficial. Our other deputy commissioner for agency relations and culture, Nikki Farrago, has been with us for many years as well, coming up through our children and family services work. She is responsible for our legislative, county, tribal, community, and federal relations functions. She also has our communications department, our Office of Employee Culture, and our Office of Equity and Inclusion. My chief of staff, Stacy Twite, does all the things she needs to do to keep everything running smoothly in the department, and our general counsel is Amy Achbein. Then we have four policy administrations responsible for helping to shape policy and then fund and regulate services. Cynthia McDonald is our assistant commissioner for the healthcare administration and also our state Medicaid director. Tiki Brown, assistant commissioner for children and families. Natasha Mers has been our interim assistant commissioner for the last several months for our aging and disability services. And Eric Gromdahl, the assistant commissioner for behavioral health, housing, and deaf and hard of hearing. Kalani Moti, our inspector general, her department, the Office of Inspector General, conducts background studies to determine if a health and human services worker has committed an act that disqualifies them from providing care, monitors compliance with licensing laws and rules, investigates maltreatment and licensing violations, audits and investigates provider and recipient fraud, waste, and abuse, and recently refocusing program integrity services on preventing and predicting financial fraud, waste, and abuse, starting with proactive, data-driven, equitable approaches in the Child Care Assistance Program and transforming child care licensing and modernizing child care licensing regulations. When I came into my position 3 years ago, just after Labor Day, my 90-day plan declared that there's nothing more important for the Minnesota Department of Human Services than to be trustworthy for the people of Minnesota, trustworthy to the people who depend on our services to live full lives in community, and trustworthy to the taxpayers of Minnesota whose resources we're entrusted with to use them properly, wisely, and effectively. After 3 years focusing there, as we begin a second term here in January, going forward, we intend to be as trustworthy to the people of Minnesota for doing our work in a more flexible and responsive fashion as we are to the taxpayers of Minnesota to have a solid approach to accounting for funds spent, especially through an ongoing workforce shortage. I'm finding more and more as I am in this position that it's all about balancing those competing priorities and trying to find a really good balance that does both and as often as we can. One of the things we put in place that should interest this committee over the last 3 years is our Medicaid decision-making initiative. It was put in place to establish decision-making authority, approval requirements, and clear accountability for any new Medicaid policy adoption, changes to policy, and fiscal impacts. It assigns formal decision-making authority to the state Medicaid director, brings together key leaders and subject matter experts across the agency to discuss and advise on Medicaid policy. establishes clear roles and shared definitions in changing and implementing processes and a formal documented decision-making process using an Agile Apps database. We took a cue from the way we handled the COVID waivers at the beginning of the pandemic, where I would make decisions about waiving rules and regulations only when the people around me, legal, finance, equity, compliance, IT, and everyone else said, yep, that's a good decision, then we would make that decision. And now this team is doing that about our Medicaid decisions. So we're putting into the past the days when someone could say, yeah, that seems about right, let's do it that way. To people having to come to this group to get a formal decision made when we make Medicaid payment decisions. As I mentioned, during COVID, we did pass 120-some waivers of rules and regulations, guidance to get counties, tribes, and providers, and all Minnesotans through the COVID shutdown days. Each one required approval from all of these different groups, and eventually MMB in the governor's office. Most have now been stood back up. We've discovered how much more difficult it is to stand rules and regulations back up than it was to waive them in the first place. And some were codified as ongoing, as you know, by the legislature. Prime example, telemedicine, which has changed everything in our world and has been a real benefit, really, of what we've learned through the COVID time. Our big project ahead of all of us, and you will hear about this as we go through the next year, is our county and tribal recertification of recipient eligibility for Medicaid and Minnesota Care, which starts now for sure in April of 23 and ends in March of 24. This is a process that our counties and tribes have done for many years. Their usual annual recertification volume is 1.2 million Minnesotans. This year they'll have 1.5 million people to work with to determine their eligibility for ongoing benefits. And they're also used to annual recertification. So if it's simply a quick update on what's true this year versus last year, that's one thing. But now the data is up to 3 years old. And so people have moved, they've had additional children, they have changes to their financial circumstances, and that all has to be updated to do a recertification of eligibility for our programs in healthcare. So you'll be hearing about this project. We brought in Deloitte to help us with project management. They're also working with other states that are standing this back up, all 50 states going through the same process this next year. And we're pleased to have some real professionals with us helping us put together a really solid plan for supporting our counties and tribes as they go through the work. We're also very committed to what we now call service delivery transformation. In the past, we would call this the IT plan. But now, we have a group of folks that are looking at investigating digital service options to reduce administrative burden on all partners and customers. Some of you have seen and heard of the Minnesota MN Benefits program, which allows an individual or a family to come in and sign up for 9 state benefits in 12 minutes on a very agile software system. This group is also working to support innovation and efficiency by providing stakeholders more direct access to our systems and our data, improve our methods of measuring and tracking public outcomes, collaborating across teams, agencies, counties, tribes, to deliver for the people we serve, and to support equity initiatives by giving direct voice to impacted populations as we do this work. This work has recently received some national attention. I've been invited to a conference of other states that are doing this kind of work because they've heard about some of the work that we're doing here in Minnesota. We're very proud of it. And now I'm going to turn it over to Dave Freeman, if I might.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. Mr. Greenman, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, for the record, my name is Dave Freeman. I'm the Chief Financial Officer with DHS, and I'm here to talk about at least Bailey and I are here to talk about some budget issues related to the department.
And if you could just move your mic a little bit.
Sure. Is that better?
Yes. Okay. Thank you.
This is sort of a high-level 101 on the Health and Human Services budget. So just to get you started off, to provide a little context around where Health and Human Services sits within the overall state budget, the slide you're looking at now shows that Health and Human Services accounts for about almost 50% of the overall state spending in the current biennium. And this, when we're looking at this, we're looking at all dollars, not just state dollars, but federal dollars as well. So one of the things to note is that this includes not only DHS, but includes the health department as well as health-related licensing boards and certain ombuds offices. However, DHS accounts for about 96% of this line, so we're a significant part of the budget for the state. If we were to just look at the same graph, but only looking at general fund, state general fund spending, we would be about 29% of the budget, and actually K-12 would be above us. They'd have about 39% of the budget. So that gives you a sense of other dollars that come into DHS other than the general fund that impact our spending. One of the things to note is that with the budget our size, we have an impact on the forecast as well. When you see the forecast come out, DHS forecast expenditures, because of the fact that we spend so much on Medicaid, when we project changes in Medicaid expenditures, which we did this last year, it does have a significant impact. I think in the last forecast, current projected general fund spending on Medicaid was reduced by about $1.2 billion in the current biennium, and I think about $700 million in the next biennium. So we have a fairly significant impact on the budget. The next slide shows where the DHS budget comes from. As you can see, a lot of it, 60% of it, is federal dollars. The predominant federal funding source for DHS is what we call is the federal match on our Medicaid spending, which, and you'll hear, both of you who are new will hear the term FFP a lot, which is federal financial participation. That's the federal share of every dollar of Medicaid spending that we do in the state. FFP for Medicaid in Minnesota is now about 51.6%. However, since COVID, since the public health emergency started, states have been eligible to receive an additional about 6.2% increase in their FFP, provided that they maintain a continuous eligibility for Medicaid. And so Minnesota has adopted that, so we've had an additional 6.2% on our Medicaid spending since March of 2020. Based on the recently passed federal budget for federal fiscal year 23, that additional FMAP is going to phase out over the next calendar year as we go through the binding process. And in addition to the COVID match, we also receive a higher Medicaid share on certain services and certain populations. So that really drives a lot of our federal funding. This next slide shows actual and projected growth in overall DHS spending from fiscal year 18 up through fiscal year 25. As you can see, our budget has grown and is projected to continue to grow significantly since 2018. We're projecting about a 45% increase in overall agency expenditures through the end of 25. What the slide also shows is the FTE totals for the department. The staffing level for the department, or nothing we call FTEs. And those numbers have remained fairly steady throughout the growth in overall expenditures, growing by about 2% over that same period versus the 45% overall agency growth. These numbers include both direct care and treatment and central office, which throws things off a little bit because a lot of our staffing is in direct care and treatment. However, you'd see it's roughly the same shape of the line if you just use central office. So central office staffing is still growing by about 2% over this time. And overall spending is about 45%. So this next slide shows, breaks out agency expenditures by various categories. And as you can see, Medicaid dwarfs the rest of the agency in terms of accounting for expenditures. Another thing to note is grants make up about 10% of our spending, and that has grown. Our grants expenditures have more than doubled in the last several years, some of it due to COVID, some of it just due to increased reliance on grants to deliver services. And that includes both largely federal but also some state grants as well. You'll notice that our non-MA forecasted programs account for about 7.5% of our budget. That includes things like the Minnesota Family Investment Program, our child care assistance program related to MFIP, our behavioral health services and housing support as well. And as you can see, the direct care and treatment program accounts for only 2.4% of the overall agency budget, and operations accounts for about 2.6%. What you'll see in the area that says pass-through and technical, what this is essentially is these are administrative dollars that get drawn down by DHS for counties and for tribal governments based on for administrative reimbursement for the work that they do. And these are federal dollars that get drawn down and passed through DHS to the counties and tribal governments. And in addition to that, as the agency that is responsible for child support collection, these are also represent child support payments that flow through DHS from the obligor to the obligee. So that's included in those amounts. So the next slide shows you where the FTEs are located within the department. We have about 6,800 FTEs currently. Approximately two-thirds of them are in direct care and treatment, which is our 24/7 behavioral health system in the state that operates programs throughout the state in larger facilities and in smaller homes. And this represents the level of staffing we need to maintain services. Over the last several years, we've had a challenge maintaining our staffing levels for DCP just because of the fact that because of the labor market, partially because of COVID, and I think we're continuing to see challenges in terms of competing with other employers for the kind of staffing we need.
And Mr. Greenman, I think it's worth pausing here just for a second. Maybe it's just me, but I remember when I was brand new in the legislature, I had no idea what DCT was. I mean, it was called State Operated Services at sure. that time. But it was a long time before I even understood what we were talking about there. So I know people come in with different levels of background on this, and so I just kind of want to put a point on this, what you're showing in these two graphs, and that is that is it a division? Is that the right language? It's a division of DHS?
It's an administration, yeah.
Administration. Okay, so it's kind of a separate animal, but it's under DHS, and this is where the state actually runs the services. We run group homes. We run a security hospital, if that's the right terminology. We actually run services, and so we actually hire the staff who deliver those services. It's very similarly to way a lot of nonprofits are doing it. So we have the same kinds of issues with recruiting people and making sure we have care staff and all of that. So that's what we're talking about, as opposed to other parts of DHS that do very different kinds of things, like administer programs, give out grants to others, administer the health care programs and so on. So I just kind of want to make sure folks understand that, because it is so foundational to what we do. And I always like to, if I can, advance people's learning so they don't have to struggle through, you know, however many terms it took me to understand some of these things. So please continue.
If I just add to that, thank you, Chair Liebling. I would just say also, if it's helpful, that the direct care and treatment health system that we run is primarily for behavioral health and primarily for people that no one else in the state can or will serve, especially people who are civilly committed to treatment. And if it's helpful, you can think about our direct care and treatment services system as about the same size as CentraCare in central Minnesota. That's about how large it is.
And Representative Bonner had her hand up. Representative Bonner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Really quick clarification. We've been talking in the last several slides a great deal about FTEs, which are full-time employees, but there is no allusion here to whether or not this is supplemented by any contract work or what role that plays in these slides. And I wonder if you could just, for the larger picture, give us some sense of whether that's included or how that plays into the equation.
Sure.
Mr. Greenman.
Madam Chair, Representative, the FTEs don't include their state employees, so they're not contract staff. We do rely on professional technical contracts, as any large agency would, when we don't have the resources or the skill set to maybe to do certain types of work that we need done. Those dollars are included in our operating budget. So if you look back at some slides, you'll see where our operating budget is about 2.6% of our overall agency spend. That those what we call professional technical contracts would be included in those. I think one of the biggest areas where we use staff that aren't actually DHS employees is Minute. Minute's a separate agency. We work very closely with Minute. There's Minute staff that's sort of located at DHS that we work with. They're not included as our staff, though, because they technically work for Minute. We pay Minute for their time, for their resources. So yeah, we do rely. I mean, it's not a large, not a huge part of our budget, but certainly we make use of professional technical contracts.
And Representative Elkins, did you have something, clarification, or should we?
Clarification. Have you guys hired a chief business technology officer at this point? I know the position was open for a while.
I believe Mr. the position Grimm. Is, I don't think we finalized the position yet. I mean, I don't think we made a final decision on the hiring.
Thank you.
Okay, please continue.
I think I'm done with this slide. So the slide I'll end with. This is really the important piece. This is the people who we serve. This provides just a brief snapshot of the populations we serve. DHS serves about 1.7 million Minnesotans, which is a little less than a third of the state population. As you can see, the largest program is Medicaid. And our average monthly enrollment in this past fiscal year that just ended was about 1.3 million, but that's continued to increase because of, as I mentioned earlier, the continuous eligibility requirements around Medicaid. So we continue to add people, but people tend to not disenroll. We're up near about 1.5 million in terms of enrollment in Medicaid right now. Starting in April, when we need to begin the public health unwind, we will need to, redeterminations of eligibility would need to be done on all 1.5 million of those people over roughly a 12-month period. So that's going to be a major stress on the department. And we've been, as the commissioner mentioned, been doing a lot to get ourselves ready for that. Some of the other groups to mention here would be two boxes in the upper right show the number of recipients using different types of long-term care services. Nursing facility average monthly recipients is about 11,600, whereas the home and community-based services, the waiver programs that you might hear about for persons with disabilities and elderly as well, is about 86.5 million. And use of those programs or enrollment in those programs has been going in different directions. The nursing home usage of nursing homes has been going down as opposed to the waivers, which have been increasing. And I think Ms. Bailey, when she talks, is going to show a little bit of information about the average cost per month of those two types of services. You've seen MFIF, average monthly enrollment is about 75,000.
And Mr. Grimm, that's an acronym that many people may not know.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The Minnesota Family Investment Program. This is our program that provides cash, food, housing support for families with children in the state. And our enrollment in that program is at about 75,000. Our child care program for families that are on MFIF is also forecasted, and that's enrollment there is about 11,000. And enrollment in MFIF child care has been going down for a number of years, and if you've seen the forecast, that we expect that to eventually rise again, but it's continuing to stay low at this point. And the last thing I would point out is the SNAP program, sort of about 445,000 people. We admit that SNAP is a federally funded program, but it's administered through DHS. And that's counted as a grant.
And Representative Fisher has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I noticed that on the Medicaid, we've got almost 1.3 million people that are covered under that. And I do know that while the department does some of that coverage for Medicaid, most of that is provided through insurance companies. What percentage of those people are actually getting when their services are done, the reimbursement is being done by the insurance companies versus from the department itself?
Mr. Grimm.
Madam Chair, Representative Fisher, about 84% of the people enrolled in Medicaid are enrolled in managed care. And I think slightly, I think of our expenditures, it's probably lower than 84% of our expenditures are on managed care because populations that tend to be fee-for-service tend to be more expensive. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Oh, I will turn it over to Ms. Bailey.
Oh, okay. In the meantime, also, Representative Bonner had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I did have one question or clarification. You mentioned sort of the MFET numbers and how things were going down, particularly for families who needed things like nutritional assistance and things like that. I know we've seen that trend going down, but I wonder if you could just quickly address the reasons why those trends have gone down and why those some of those trends may go back up, and in particular the role that federal funds may have played in some of that equation.
Mr. Greenman.
Chair, Representative, certainly we saw use of a lot of our forecast programs decline during COVID. If people just weren't going out, they weren't working, child care centers were closing, or there's a hard time in child care. That led to a lot of decline in the use. I think we have, as an agency, we've looked at reasons why usage has gone down. Certainly access is one of the challenges we have. However, we have, for the past several forecasts, our team has projected increases. They've assumed it's going to start to rise again. It continues to stay low, though. So we're not 100% sure why it's continued to stay at that level. Certainly, we have the enrollment in MFIP, or the Family Investment Program. We have families with kids on MFIP. They may be using other sources of child care other than what we'd be reimbursed through this forecasted program. I think we're still looking at why that's happening. But it's not something we expect to continue for this long.
Okay, members, we've got a couple more members with questions. I think what I'd really like to do is let the department finish quickly going through the slides and hold the rest of the questions for the end, if we could, so that we can get through this. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Elise Bailey. I'm the budget director for the Department of Human Services, and I'm going to take a little bit of a deeper dive into our program spending. As Mr. Greenman kind of noted in his slides, in fiscal 22, we served over 1.4 million people on our forecasted programs. And so you'll see on this slide all of our kind of big buckets of forecast spending of about $18.1 billion in fiscal year 22. So this is all funds. If you just took the state amount, it would be about $6 billion in that year. The majority of the spending in our forecasted programs, as Mr. Greenman kind of noted, is in our Medicaid program. It's about 91% of the spending on this slide is in our MA or Medicaid program, about $16.5 billion total. A lot of times when you see our forecasted documents, you'll see our MA spending split out among different eligibility categories or different types of spending, and you'll see that on this slide. The most expensive part of our MA budget is for services provided to people with disabilities and older adults and through home and community-based services and through facility-based care. And so you'll see that in the first row, it's about 33.6% of our total forecast spending is on those services. The next three lines are our different eligibility categories through what we call the basic care spending in our MA program. This is the traditional spending that we would have that doesn't go into home care, home and community-based services, or facility-based care. And so you'll see those three lines below: 20% for families with kids, about 18.8% for basic care provided to people with disabilities and older adults, and 18% of the total spend for Medicaid provided to adults without kids. Beyond that, you'll see our other forecasted programs, such as Minnesota Care, the MFIP, and child care programs through our forecasted programs. North Star Care is spending or care provided to kids in the foster care system. housing support and services provided through our behavioral health fund or for chemical dependency services. So this slide just kind of gives a brief snapshot of our big bucket of spending on MA. We spent $16.5 billion in fiscal year 2022 and had an average monthly enrollment of about 1.3 million people. As Mr. Greenman mentioned, that has risen over the span of the pandemic as we've had continuous coverage requirements in our state. Minnesota Care, our total expenditures were $637 million in fiscal year 2022, and the average monthly enrollment was around 105,000 people across the state. The next slide. There we go. this slide kind of details what source of funding is behind our MA expenditures. As Mr. Greenman mentioned, we get a significant amount of federal funding for a Medicaid program, and you'll see that in the blue section of these bars where it has really risen over time, especially during the pandemic where we've had increased federal match. Through our enhanced FMAP. The green part of the slide is the state funding, so that has also slightly risen, but not as fast as the federal spending. There are some instances where we have a local share, for instance, in facility-based care, and so you'll see a very slight proportion of our spending there. And we also have a small amount spent through the Healthcare Access Fund. So the amount of spending really depends on the type of eligibility category, as I went over a few slides ago. You'll see in this slide is pretty interesting on the number of people that we serve juxtaposed with how much we spend on those populations. So as I mentioned, the majority of our spending is in home and community-based services and facility-based care, with $9.5 billion spent in fiscal year 2022, with the average monthly enrollees at our lowest amount of 187,000. This, of course, is due to the higher cost for serving those folks. And you'll see the largest population is our children and families at about 830,000 people we serve every month at a cost of $3.7 billion. And lastly, our last category, the adults without kids, that we have a total expenditure of $3.3 billion, but this population we get a 90% federal match on. And so the amount of state funding actually within this graph is $328 million. This next slide just shows the increase in average monthly costs per person over time. The line on the top is our long-term care facilities. So you'll see the slope of that line is significantly higher than the slopes of the lines below. And that's really due to increases in rates paid to nursing homes over time. This next slide, you'll see our forecast trends in the Minnesota Care Program. So the Minnesota Care Program is another public health program provided to folks with low income that don't qualify for Medicaid. In fiscal year 2022, as I mentioned before, we spent about $637 million total for this population. And you'll see that actually the federal share has grown over time, particularly during the pandemic and going forward due to federal dollars that we'll receive for serving these folks. The Minnesota Care Program is a little bit different than Medicaid in that the federal dollars we get is about 95% of the tax credits that the person would have get if they would have purchased health care through the exchange. And so that really shifts due to changes on the federal level on how much those credits are paid. And then the last slide just kind of quickly goes over our grant expenditures. So these are our non-forecast program spending at the Department of Human Services. It encompasses about 10% of our total budget. But you'll see within this slide, 55% of that is in our nutrition and housing budget activity, which most of this is around our SNAP program, the nutrition assistance provided to families and kids. We served over 445,000 people and with an average payment amount of $190 per month provided to those families. You'll see also 13% of our grant spending is in child care, and the majority of this is in through our basic sliding fee program. We served over 12,000 kids in this bucket at about $125 million in fiscal year 21. We have a significant amount of grants in our behavioral health area, disabilities, and aging and long-term care, and employment services you'll see in this slide, too. So with that, I'll stand for questions.
All right. So I'm going to we have a couple members with questions. I think we could go over just by just a few minutes if you folks have the time. And before I do go to the questions, I just would explain to members that even though obviously this year we have the Human Services Committees, both policy and finance, those are separate here, but there is some crossover of the things that we do and have under our jurisdiction with the things that go on in the Department of Human Services, and that's why we're bringing you both, and you're going to need to have some familiarity with both agencies, although we're not going to be quite as deeply involved with the Department of Human Services. But certainly the public health care programs are under the department, as you've heard. So that's going to be very important for us. I also do just want to say, while I have the microphone, I also really want to compliment the department, as I did with the Department of Health, just so that folks understand. Commissioner Harpstead came in and has done an amazing job of really wrangling this difficult beast called the Department of Human Services, because it's enormous and it does a lot of things. And it's very complicated, very complicated. And she's just worked so hard and been so effective at making the department much more accountable, as she started out saying. And of course, there's always more to do. You just cannot have something as big and complex as this and never make any mistakes and never overlook anything. But they also have been, and their employees have been through a lot with the pandemic, pivoting very quickly to try to continue to provide services under unprecedented conditions. And they've just done an amazing job. So I really want to give a shout out to the commissioner and her entire staff across the entire agency for the amazing work they continue to do every single day. And with that, I'm going to call on Representative Murphy, who hasn't asked a question yet this time, and then we'll go to Representative Nadeau. Representative Murphy.
This is really for both commissioners. With regard to planning and funding, what entities do you take direction from? CDC, NIH, WHO, or the UN?
And Representative Murphy, the Department of Health commissioner isn't here now any longer, but for human services, I'm sure the commissioner can address it. Commissioner.
Yes, Chair Liebling and Representative. When you're talking about, for example, the use of federal funds?
Yes.
Yeah. So an awful lot of it, as you've seen, is the Medicaid program. So CMS is one of the agencies that we work with constantly in Washington. For our children and family services, the administration for children and families, part of the federal government, and then lots and lots of other parts of the federal government. SAMHSA is our mental health federal agency, for example, and so there's probably a federal agency for every administration, even every program in the Department of Human Services. But the largest ones, I would say, are probably CMS, Medicaid, and the Administration for Children and Families.
Representative Murphy.
I'm sorry. Does the World Health Organization give you guidelines at all, or the United Nations? And I've seen some guidelines at the county level. I'm just curious if that comes from us.
Don't hear about
Commissioner.
Much. Sorry, Chair Liebling. Still getting used to this. Don't hear very much about those. And they would be mostly, I would assume, Department of Health kinds of guidelines if there were.
Okay. All right. Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, I expected, since the waivers were on, I mean, everybody stayed on waivers during COVID, I just anticipated that number to go down. And what I've heard today is that you're expecting the MA eligibility number to go up to 1.5. Is that, that's what the new expectation is? Did I hear that wrong, or?
If I might.
Commissioner.
Yeah, Chair Liebling. So, Representative, what happened was during COVID, and you heard somebody mention this, that to get that increased federal match, we needed to keep people who were on Medicaid until the end of the pandemic. And so the people that became eligible were added, and everyone stayed on it. So that is why we now have 1.5 million Minnesotans enrolled in Medicaid. And so now we have to go back and check to see if they're actually eligible for Medicaid and decide who stays on Medicaid now going forward. Does that answer your question?
Yes, and you're I'm sorry, you're expecting that number to be at the 1.5 million. That's the estimate.
It's, yes.
Commissioner.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Nadeau. So the next hearing is going to be on Thursday. We're going to hear House File 91. And with that, thank you. Thank you very much, Commissioner. Thank you to your staff. And appreciate everyone's attendance today. We stand adjourned.